verses and the discussion of ancient texts is something that have been going on for thousands of years. And now this very same tradition is also happening here. We are, in this portion of Srimad Bhagavatam, describing things that transpired in the shortly after the creation of the universe. So the history of the Vedas goes back for a very long time, and even what happened millions of years ago, at least the most important things have been recorded. Nowadays, history is simply a record of the activities of politicians. But at that time, history was referring to the records of the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and of saintly personalities. So, especially in the beginning of the universe, there were very powerful, saintly personalities present. And because these personalities were very powerful, there was also intimate exchanges between them and the Supreme Lord. So one of these powerful sages is Atri Muni. And Atri Muni was performing austerities. And ultimately, for the sake of making the Supreme Lord appear. So he's performing certain purificatory activities to please the Lord. And ultimately, there was a reciprocation of the Lord. And then he had prayed to the Lord for a son who was just like the Supreme Lord. And he was approaching the Supreme Lord. So, to his surprise, three deities appeared before him. Lord Brahma, Lord Vishnu, and Lord Shiva. So, Lord Brahma is a very powerful personality who is involved in the creation of the universe. Lord Vishnu is involved in the maintenance of the universe, and Lord Shiva is involved in the destruction of the universe. It is said that of these three activities, the maintenance is the greatest work, because creation is done basically once, and then it's finished. So it's a lot of work to maintain, to create something, but to maintain something is even more work. So therefore it is said that for the creation and the destruction, which is done only once, the Lord could depute his representatives. So Lord Brahma was doing that, and that creation, and Lord Shiva was doing that destruction. But for the maintenance, no one had the power, and therefore the Supreme Lord expended himself in the form of Lord Vishnu, while the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna himself continued to engage in pleasure pastimes. Because why would the Supreme Personality of Godhead have to work? In some religious scriptures, we find that there will be a heaven on earth, and that there is, but then there are some who are in heaven. And the ones who are in heaven, they're basically administrating all the universal affairs. So there's a concept of God as a manager, as an organizer, as running a government, the government of the universe, and he has to make sure that everything goes on fine. But it is not a fact that the Supreme Lord is seated in the control room, and that he has a very big computer, and where he regularly types in different commands just to make sure, you know, some disturbance in the program, right? What's going on, the sunset is not happening properly, we have to fix this. Nothing like that. The Supreme Lord is not involved in actively upholding the universal affairs. The Supreme Lord rather is engaged in his pleasure pastimes. But for universal affairs, he has his agents, his representatives. And for some things that no one else can do, he simply expands himself and takes another form. And in that way, he will do it himself. Why Atri Muni, who was approaching the Supreme Lord, a great sage who was performing austerities, and due to his sincere attempts was able to attract the Supreme Lord, or rather was able to attract these three deities, that is certainly extraordinary. An interesting point is it will become clarified in the next few days why this happened, why three deities came instead of one. The underlying reason of it all is because Atri Muni was not in full knowledge. He was not fully fixed in understanding what actually is the summum bonum, the topmost thing. In that, Atri Muni is not alone. Practically in the whole world, nobody knows what is the greatest thing. If we would ask people, what is the greatest thing? You get all kinds of answers, right? And many of them might be very stupid, you know. What is the greatest thing, you know? Some would mention the name of a certain drink. Others would mention football for sure, you know. Some would manage the name of their country, right? Some would mention money, right? Some would say sex, right? Like that, I can imagine many things that people would say when we would ask for the greatest thing. And someone would say Mickey Mouse, right? And in that way, we understand that people have no idea what is the greatest thing. So it is very difficult to actually understand what is the greatest thing in life. It's hard to make a choice. What is the greatest thing? There's a big dilemma. But such a question can be easily answered by one who has a connection with a self-realized spiritual master. Because the self-realized spiritual master is one who is Srutyam Brahmanistam. He has heard transcendental knowledge, and therefore he is fixed in knowing the answer to all questions. And therefore he knows the purpose of life. So in this way, by the association with such a person, one can also become very clear. And we see that this is the case with the devotees of this movement. Prior to Krishna consciousness, we also didn't quite know what to do, what not to do. I was reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and then a little later I was looking in the I Ching, and then I didn't mind at all to have a look at the Vedas and maybe read the New Testament in between, and you know, and then some mundane stuff, some science fiction literatures, and when it came to the issue of God, I thought it was all spiritual. Right? I thought it was all spiritual, and didn't have such a clear vision. Sometimes we compare that to taking pictures. If you go on holidays and you forgot your camera, then you can buy on the airport one of those paper cameras, you know. They're really like, so it's just a paper box, a little lens, and there you go with your pictures. And when you come home and you see your pictures, then, well, the close-ups are not so bad, but the long-distance pictures, you know, are totally useless with those cameras. Absolutely. You don't see anything. It's just one big blur, you know. Just like, you can not even recognize your friend who was standing in the landscape. He's just some figure, you know. I can't even properly see who it is. So, in the beginning, when we approach the absolute truth, or who is the Supreme Lord, all we have is a little paper camera. And we just take a picture of the Lord with paper camera, and it all looks kind of spiritual and all kind of unclear. But then, as we, through hearing from saintly personalities, we get better lenses, better angles on the matter. Through different arguments and reasons, we begin to get better angles. And then, you know, when we finally, hear many, many good reasons why Krishna is the Supreme Lord, then we get a zoom lens and we just can see, yes, it's Krishna. The greatest thing in life is devotion, is to be the servant of Krishna. That's quite a realization. And in the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Bhavanam jamanamante jnanavam amprapadyante vasudeva sarvam iti samahatma sudurlabha. That it takes many births for someone to come to that point, to actually realize that. So, it could take a long time. And one could be a Buddhist for a lifetime and take his birth in Asia and just eat with chopsticks and everything and be totally Asian. So Asian, you know, like you think, like, so alien almost from European, you know, so far away. That's so totally different. Sometimes you think Chinese are from another planet. You're just totally so different. So different in their ways and thinking. And then in the next life, why not in America, right? And in God we trust. It's printed on the dollar bill, right? And in that way, you can approach God through money, right? In the United States of America. By the way, actually, Americans are much more religious than the Dutch. There's a much higher percentage of Americans believing in God than in this neck of the world. In this part of the world, the rates of believing God are a bit on the low side. Whatever may be. So one can take his birth in different countries and cultivate different conceptions, life after life. The seed of a particular belief may already be there, and then it is reinforced by living in a particular environment. And whatever world we grow up in, that we consider reality. But what is reality? Is reality Chinese, or is reality American, or is reality from the Middle East? What is reality? The views are totally different. So in this way, life after life, we can have different experiences of reality. But this is all relative. It is always changing. And it takes many, many lifetimes to actually come to the point of seeing the absolute truth. In order to approach Krishna, one must be free from working for one's own self-interest. In order to approach Krishna, one must simply dedicate himself to the glorification of Krishna. In order to approach Krishna, we must not look for any gains, neither at the present, nor should we look for any improved conditions in the future and make a sacrifice now in the hope to get a reward later. No. All these things cannot be there when one approaches Krishna. But in so many lives, we have so many desires to improve our condition of life. I hope I'm going to get rich. Oh, do I hope. I will never get married unless she's rich. For example. And beautiful, of course. You know, that's obvious. Something like that. Fine. You know, that may be. So there's hope to get rich somehow or other. Hope to improve the conditions of life. We are working very hard on our future. You know, I mean, we're making a real sacrifice now. We're working double jobs, but it's, you know, we hope that eventually we can buy a house and then, you know, we're really building up the future. Yeah. But, you know, meanwhile, what is your future, you know? The future is that you will be in an old people's home, right? For sure. It's looking from the window if someone will come to visit. That is the future, right? The future is old age, right? All wrinkled up and shriveled up and so on, right? With no energy left,
That is the future.
So, we are, it may take many births to get to the point where we are free from personal interest and personal desire. And the more we give up personal desires, the more the Supreme Lord reveals himself. Krishna is everywhere, but he's covered. Naam prakasa sarvasya yoga maya samavritaha. Krishna covers himself and we cannot see him. We cannot perceive him. So this is the point that we are, that Krishna is always there. But due to our self-interest, we become covered and are not able to see him. So as we become more and more involved in doing what is advantageous for Krishna and leaving behind our own personal interest, the more Krishna will reveal himself to us. At that stage, Krishna consciousness becomes a reality. At that stage, Krishna consciousness is no longer a philosophy. At that stage, Krishna consciousness is not something from a book, but at that stage, Krishna consciousness is something tangible, something we can experience in life, and that's everywhere. And the book is a support, and it helps us to deeper understand what we're experiencing. But at that stage, Krishna consciousness is an actual experience, and that is what it's meant to be. I said it takes many lifetimes of trying to fulfill so many desires. But then the pure devotee, he can step into the middle of our life and move us forward. He can just move us forward along all these lives. He can just like pick us up and just make us skip so many lifetimes. Millions of lifetimes can just become unnecessary due to the association of devotee, of the pure devotee. He can change our heart. He can change our desires. He can change our karma. He can change our destiny, right? And so much so that we can actually suddenly begin to see, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Suddenly the mystery of who is God becomes unraveled and we can see it very clear. It's Krishna, without a doubt. Right? Without a doubt. It all makes sense. It is all very logical. In that way we are seeing more and more how, why would Krishna, right? Why would he not be the enjoyer? Makes sense. As I said in the beginning, why would Krishna as a controller work very hard? Krishna is holding all the planets in place. But Prabhupada said, not like Atlas, you know, who stands there with planet Earth on his back and is looking for someone. Can you hold this for a moment? I'll be right back. Right? Just looking for someone to, for a moment at least, take this heavy burden of, and he's just carrying the earth of his back. The Supreme Lord is simply by his will sustaining all the universes and all the planetary systems in their orbits. That is what is happening. It is simply all going on by desire. He doesn't have to work. And wherever the Lord, out of his kind mercy, is interacting with the material world, he expands himself into other forms. Krishna just takes other forms, and then these other forms are dealing with the universal creation. And it is not that the Supreme Lord has to do that. He doesn't have to expand himself to deal with the universal creation personally. But the reason is because he's kind. He does it for us so that we have the opportunity to see how everything is going on by personal arrangements. It's very interesting that Lord Brahma, when he is born, appears from a lotus flower type form that manifests from the navel of Lord Vishnu, and how there's like a string coming from the navel of Lord Vishnu, and then with a lotus at the end on which Lord Brahma is sitting. So similar to our own birth. So it makes sense that there is a continuity in the whole universe, that what we're experiencing in our own little realm is of the same nature as what exists in everywhere else. Aren't we feeling a connection? Aren't we feeling immediately some sense of happiness when the sun starts shining? And don't we immediately feel some pressure upon us when there's dark gray clouds? Just 2 days ago, when we were celebrating Lord Nityananda's appearance day, I was in Spain and the sun was shining and it suddenly was really warm. And we were sitting outside, taking prasadam in the sun. It was Spain at its best, right? Like, you know, it's not always like that, but it was really good. And it was just like summer in the middle of February, like a Dutch summer. So nice. Very nice. Amazing. So what can we say? Immediately something inside of us, something inside of recognizes this as, yes, this is it, you know? This is good. This is where I belong. Yes, this is exactly the right thing for me. I feel totally comfortable now, right? So we have that connection. We have a very much a connection with everything, right? I mean, sometimes you look at paintings and they change all the colors and there's a sky which is poison green, you know? And it's intense, a painting like that, right? You look at a poison green sky and you feel like, whew, there's some cold, something really unpleasant. Light can have such an effect. In Germany, in Munich, there's an airport with a very, very long tunnel. Very long tunnel of like kilometers long. And in there, they have from these real chemical colors of light, of like pink and chemical blue and chemical green, etc. Really like, and it's all flashing, right? With silver metal mirrors, you know. And you walk through there, and you feel like you're getting hypnotized or something, and you really have to fight, you know, to stay conscious. It's so intense. It's a really intense airport. It's like, I call it the hypno tunnel, you know. And it's a very awkward place to go through. Surrealistic. So what can we say? We have an intimate relationship with the environment. And so therefore, it's not, there is the universe, that's one thing, and then there's us, that is another. No, we're very much part of it. We're an intricate part of it. We're intimately connected to it, and it's part of us. You know, the moon is part of us, the moon in my mind, you know. The sun is part of us, right? The stars are part of us, right? Yes, me and the stars, starry eyes, and all these things are part of us. So, we have an intimate relationship with the entire, with nature and the universe. And the Supreme Lord equally has an intimate relationship with the entire creation, with the universe and so on. And so through that, we also have an intimate relationship with the Supreme Lord. Everything is emanating from Him. So in that way, He is very kind that He is manifesting Himself as a personality in creating all these things and maintaining all these things in so many different forms. And then that behind Him there are many other personalities who are His energies and who are empowered. Like Brahma is a very large, empowered being, very intelligent, who can do many, many things. And equally so, Lord Shiva is a very empowered being. But in spite of them being so empowered, and much more empowered than we are, they are never the Supreme Lord. We are also empowered. We can do so many things. So all living beings are sharing in the power of the Supreme Lord. It is not only that the Supreme Lord is powerful, but all of us are powerful. We also have power. So, it is said that the more one surrenders to the Supreme Lord, the more powerful one becomes. And the more one ignores the Supreme Lord and goes against the Supreme Lord, the less powerful one becomes. Sometimes for a while, a person who is not surrendering to the Lord may still become powerful. And that is due to some past good or devotional activity. But then after some time, surely he will lose his power if he's not surrendering to the Supreme Lord. And even one who is not powerful, when he surrenders to the Supreme Lord, he will become powerful. Yasyasti bhaktir bhagavatira kinchana sarvir gunaistratra samastate sara harava bhaktasho kuto mahat guna manuratena savidavato bahi. So we can see that one who is surrendering to the Supreme Lord will develop all the good qualities of the devas, of the divine beings, of the demigods. And one, even if he has all good qualities, if he's not engaging in the service of the Lord, he will lose all good qualities. This is Srimad Bhagavatam. So there is great wisdom here. So the topic of good qualities is a very important topic. Because we're seeing that good qualities lead to good activity, which leads to good good results. And bad qualities lead to activities that cause suffering to ourselves and to other living beings. So in this way, when activities actually cause distress and suffering to other living beings, then how can they be good? You say, well, sometimes there is some distress which is being caused for giving a good result in the long term, right? Like the dentist, you know, it's ultimate distress, right? I mean, that somehow or other we voluntarily go in that building, right, with a knot in our stomach, right, and we go in that room, and he says, sit down, and thinking, something in our mind tells us, why am I doing this? I don't have such toothache at all. I feel much better now. Do I really need this? I don't think so. But we sit down anyway, and then it starts, right? And the suffering is intense, but in the hope for getting a better end result. So sometimes there may be some temporary suffering for getting a good result in the end. That's another matter. But otherwise, activities that lead to suffering, right, are destructive activities. If they don't bring about a good result in the end, then they're bad. So it is so simple, after understanding Srimad Bhagavatam, what are good qualities and what are bad qualities? It's not such a mental question anymore. What is good and what is bad? And big professors sit down and say, it was very complex to answer this question. But actually it becomes very simple and down to earth and practical and something we can engage in. Good and bad. And good is uplifting. And good is benefiting all. Good is that activity which increases the happiness of all living beings. Good is not the activity which brings happiness to one and suffering to other. I will eat you. No, please. No. It will make me very happy if I eat you. No, but I will. It won't make me happy anyway. What can we do? Right? So if we build our happiness on the suffering of other living beings, what kind of happiness is that? That's not complete happiness. So good are those activities that are increasing the happiness of all living beings. Very simple. And Srimad Bhagavatam is teaching us how to engage in those activities. Those are the activities of devotional service. So how nice is it to be a devotee? It is really bringing peace to the mind, because you know that the things that you're doing for your happiness are also ultimately bringing happiness to all. Maybe it may take a little time, you know, to really, really, really become totally happy, but that is the actual path of spiritual life. So in that way, Krishna consciousness is a great boon. And there is no better activity, really. There's nothing greater. And that's why a book like Srimad Bhagavatam is worth discussing. In fact, we find that as we every day make it a culture of assembling in the morning and discussing the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, that it gives us tremendous strength and inspiration to actually engage in activities which are ultimately for the benefit of all. Sometimes it involves bringing sacrifice. Sometimes it involves doing things which are not easy. Sometimes it even involves that we voluntarily take difficulties, right? So voluntarily accept difficulties means voluntary suffering, right? Yes, that may be that we take some difficulty, but the end result will be great satisfaction, and that is very nice. So when we are satisfied, then we can actually, that's actually the essence. That's what life is about, to be satisfied. The whole world is unfortunately filled at this point of time by people who are not satisfied and who are desperately looking here and there and who are desperately trying to give some meaning in their life and are trying to express that through their dress, through their work, through their art, and in so many ways. But all that, actually, we see, like I saw just the other day, some sort of poster which, about some play or something, which said, the smile shining through the tears, right? It's just like the bar on the corner, right? A smile and a tear, it's called, right? A smile and a tear, it's called. So like this, you know, people are just looking, I'm singing in the rain, you know, that old song, right? All the same theme, you know, like we're suffering like hell, but doesn't matter. I keep on smiling, you know. It's not going to get me down, you know. I keep on smiling, right? Boom, I just lost my leg. Anyway, I'll dance on one leg, you know, no problem, right? I'll keep on jumping, you know, like, yes. I won't give up. And I once even, now that I'm on the topic, there was a book about one man who had some nervous disorder, a particular disease of the nerves, and the result of it was that gradually his control over his whole body was getting less and less and less. So slowly the functions of the whole body were breaking down. And like it started in all kinds of places. The whole body was affected by this disease and it happened here and there. Then his toe wasn't working. And then it was getting difficult to open and close the eyes, so the eyelids started hanging a little, and then, you know, so slowly it was getting more and more difficult. Now, he was a professor, and as a professor in a university, he was always a very personal professor, who had always taught, he was very popular with his students, and he had always taught his students, not only the knowledge of the books, of the textbooks, but he also taught them the knowledge of life, right? So he felt, now that I'm a teacher, so I should die as a teacher, right? I should die as a teacher, and I should show people that you can die a happy man, right? So the whole book was written by then one of his students. He somehow or other got in contact again with one of his old students, who himself was a little stuck in life and not satisfied, and he became like his disciple practically. So here the whole book is like almost like a guru-disciple relationship, you know, the teacher and the student, after all. And it's a lesson about life, and the topic is how to die. And then we see how he was trying to die and just be, say, well, you know, okay, I'm just accepting it. First of all, I'm not fighting it, I'm accepting it, everyone has to go. So, okay, I'll accept it, you know, no problem. And I'm just not gonna give up enjoying life, you know. I'll just keep on enjoying life till the very end. I mean, I'll live a full life till the end, you know. And that's the most beautiful thing, right? And it's like, so there he was, you know, one half now didn't work anymore. One arm didn't work. One eye didn't work. But then there's still, they're celebrating a birthday party with candles and the cakes, you know, and party hats, and everyone was there. And he was saying, he was just sitting there like at the table, couldn't properly move. But everyone had assembled anyway to just go on. And he was saying, yes, this is how I want it, you know. Why should we stop enjoying the pleasures of life? We should just go on. And in this way, he's trying to show that no matter what's happening, it's not getting me. It's not breaking me mentally, you know. It hasn't broken me. It didn't get me under. You know, I didn't like become depressed by it all. I just stayed in good consciousness, and that was his lesson and his message. But you know, at one point it does become a bit pathetic, right? When you know, paralyzed up to the neck and still a party hat on. You know, at one point you say like, look, you know, let's be real, you know. Maybe this is not a party, right? Maybe this is really not so much fun anymore. And maybe it's crazy to celebrate a party right now, right? You know, that's ridiculous, right? So, there's a deeper level. How much more wonderful was the departure of Srila Prabhupada, who simply taught to all that we are not this body. Of course, we have this body. And now that I'm in my final days, my body is very much incapacitated. What can be done? But we must indeed use this body till the very end for the benefit of all. For the best work that we can do, that we must do. So we will continue to work till the very end, for the benefit of all living beings. And Prabhupada did that. And in that way, the way he was leaving his body was deep and noble. It wasn't like with a party hat on and like, you know, and still blowing out candles and, I don't know, balloons and everything, you know. Yeah, we're going out with a party. It wasn't like that. It was like, yes, this is not fun, right? This is intense, right? This is not an easy moment, but no matter what, we will keep on using this body, although it's breaking down, for the benefit of all, because this is the greatest thing we can do with our life, to do something for the benefit of all. So when we're seeing that, then we see this is deep, this is noble, this is honest, not artificial. The other thing, although sincerely meant, you know, and I have all respect actually for this person who tried to go this path, right? The story in that book is even that at one point, he felt like people that are dying, they're always hiding. You know? They're always hiding, you know, they're hiding. So he felt like, no, I will die in front of the world, this professor, right? So the professor was saying, I will die in front of the world. And therefore, he went on the TV, you know, and with his whole bad condition, and okay, he gave his philosophy and his spirit of it. I won't let it take me down. We'll just go on and have loving exchanges with my friends and everyone, and relish it and so on, you know. And he got into that, and then they filmed him again a few months later when he was still worse, etc. You know, so it was going on like that. And the TV The TV reporter asked him, "What do you think will be, what is the worst thing, you know, that's in your mind in this whole situation? What's the worst thing that weighs on your mind?" And in the first TV program, he was saying, "The worst thing that weighs on my mind is the thought that very soon, after going to the toilet, I won't be able to clean myself anymore, and that I will be dependent on someone else to do it." Well, you may make a face, but the mind is like that. You know, we do get embarrassed about these certain things like that. You know, he was very honest like that, the man, very honest. You know, most people wouldn't be that honest. So again, you have to see it a little deeper than just the gross expert. No, he was very honest the way he was dying. And he just said, "Well, let me just accept things as they are, and not hide it, and not try to make it more beautiful, not gloss it over, and let me just be honest and go through the experience and try and make the best of it all along the way." So that was the philosophy. But then Prabhupada, right, also died publicly, also left his body publicly. One time when I was in India, there was one of the older devotees, Indian devotee, and his father died. And then he came to me, and after his father had left, he had gone home, and he had been there, and then he had taken photos, and he came to me and he showed me all the photos of how his father died. And I was fresh from the West going, "Oh my God, you know, I mean, what are these photos? How can you show me these photos of your father? He's dying." And it's too much, you know, like, look at all these photos. And it's going, wow. But Prabhupada also died in that way, right? Being filmed and publicly, and inviting everyone to come. Being very happy that many devotees came. But Prabhupada was not thinking of somehow or other that his dying was now the center of everything. When Dayananda, one of Prabhupada's first disciples, came, Dayananda was in Iran in those days, and he used to be actively a temple devotee, but later he had taken a job outside, and at that time he was working outside in Iran. So he came to Prabhupada wearing his suit, straight from work, because he had come straight off the plane, and Prabhupada was dying, you know. So there's no time to waste, and he was just flying in, coming straight to see him. He didn't even take bath or anything. As soon as he reached Vrindavan, he wanted to see Prabhupada. So he even didn't change. He just saw him in those clothes that he came from his work. He just dropped everything to go see Prabhupada. So he saw Prabhupada like that, and Prabhupada saw him like that. And Prabhupada said, "So, you are in Iran? Yes. You are working? Yes." He said, "So, what you are doing with the money?" He said, "I'm giving 50% to the temple, Prabhupada." Prabhupada said, "Oh, that's very nice. That's very nice." Then Prabhupada smiled, put his hand on Dayananda's head, and blessed him, and said, "Yes, you always continue like that. That is very nice." So in this way, the center of what was happening there was not that Prabhupada was dying, that Prabhupada is leaving his body, and that the impending death was the main thing. That was not the main thing, although it was obviously a big thing. And in the minds of the disciples, it was the main thing. But in the minds of Prabhupada, it was not the main thing. The main thing was still Krishna. Right? That was it. The main thing was still Krishna, even at the time as he was leaving the body. So in any conversation, right, the main discussion topic was not dying. The main discussion topic was Krishna. And in this way, it was Prabhupada who was actually blessing everyone and giving everyone Krishna, rather than that people were giving him comfort and helping him to somehow or other, you know, at this terrible moment of leaving the body, to deal with it. Right? And that way, Prabhupada showed his greatness and really how to live and how to use this entire life for the benefit of all. So, that is only possible for one who begins at an early stage in life. If we begin now to work for the benefit of all, right? If now we begin to work for the happiness of all living beings, only then can we continue to do so until the end of our life. And then our life will become wonderful, and then our destination at the end of life will also become wonderful. And that is actually the goal of life. Okay, if I can stop with that, maybe there are questions or comments.
You spoke about becoming powerful, and the other things like powerful.
Yes. Basically that a devotee, as he's surrendering to Krishna, becomes powerful. And the question is in which way he becomes powerful. He becomes powerful because he becomes fixed in his determination. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, Vyavasyatmika buddhir ekaha kuru nandana bahusaki anantasta. What is it? Vyavasayinam. Can you look up the last line if you remember? I just remember, I forgot one word. Buddhayo vyavasayinam. Thank you. Buddhayo vyavasayinam. So the gist of that verse is that the materialistic person, his intelligence and his whole energy becomes many-branched. Right? His determination is everywhere. He's thinking, maybe this will make me happy, but rather than maybe that will make me happy. Maybe this person will make me happy, but then again, maybe that person will make me happy. And maybe I should stay here, but then again, maybe I should go, and maybe I could be more successful somewhere else in the world, and then again, maybe if I do this work, then I would be happy, but then again, if I don't work at all, I might be more happy. And but a person who is dedicating himself as a servant of Krishna, and he becomes the well-wisher of all living beings, right? Such a person has only one purpose. He becomes fixed in purpose, one purpose. So what power is there, right? All these other things, it's not important anymore. So the one thing, so there comes from this determination, there is so much power, right? And that is then, because one can then dedicate himself with so much concentration on the service of Krishna, then Krishna will also reciprocate in different ways. And sooner or later, Krishna will also give more and more abilities. And Krishna will help the devotee to do things that he normally could have never done, but somehow or other is going on. So it's not just that the devotee develops power by his own hard labor and work, but it's also that Krishna is somehow or other just showering benedictions. Just like Srimati Radharani is the topmost devotee, and her beauty is exquisite, right? Her body is just unmatched. No one is as beautiful as she is, right? Her beauty is not the gorgeous beauty of the movie star type, or the model that kills, but her beauty is the beauty of purity, the beauty of, like, it is kind of a beauty that is touching the heart. Right? The beauty of Srimati Radharani is not the kind of beauty that just incites lust, but it is the kind of beauty that brings out that immediately moves the heart. One sees, you know, like she is purity personified. She is humility personified. She is surrender personified. She is just love personified. And when one sees the beauty of Srimati Radharani, one feels humbled. One feels moved. One feels touched. One feels also inspired towards these qualities. So in this way, a devotee becomes empowered with love and all the symptoms of love for Krishna. Yes.
Considering the same topic, I was just thinking about the example of Arjuna when he was empowered to fight in the Kurukshetra and he was doing the war successfully. But after that war, and it's amazing that I think before Krishna was not Krishna, but once he was beaten up by a coward.
Yeah, after Krishna left. Krishna gives also power and may also take away power. Krishna empowers a person for a particular mission, and he can withdraw that power again when the mission is completed, as he showed in the case of Arjuna, who was the most powerful warrior during the Battle of Kurukshetra, and after the war, suddenly his power was gone. So that's also possible. But the core of Arjuna's power remained the same. Although his material power may be given and taken away by Krishna, but the power of his determination to serve Krishna remained. And therefore his love for Krishna remained. So the power of his love was not diminished. That only increased by all these things, right? So as he was going through the external experiences of being empowered and disempowered, his love for Krishna actually increased by that. Because his dependence on Krishna was increased. So sometimes Krishna takes away also the power of a devotee, the material power of a devotee. And that's a little painful. But in that pain, a devotee will take shelter of Krishna. And therefore his dependence on Krishna even increases. And that's Krishna's arrangement. So Krishna gives and Krishna takes away from us for the purpose of increasing our dependence on him. And in that way, the love in the heart of the devotee grows and grows. Any other? Yeah.
I once heard that Srila Prabhupada is actually one of the gopis.
You hear all kinds of things. Prabhupada himself said in this regard, when some devotees were inquiring about what Prabhupada's swarup was, his eternal spiritual identity, he said in a very serious voice, that you do not require. Yeah. So we take it like that, you know, that we don't require. So in other words, it was a polite way of saying, mind your own business. you know, that's none of your business, you know. Mind your own business. You take care of getting out of the material world and don't worry about my relationship with Krishna. It's not your concern. It's not important. All you need to do is you engage in devotional service according to the process and you will develop your relationship with Krishna, whatever my relationship is. Don't worry about it. But generally, the intimate associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are, by the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he bestows Madhurya Rasa upon them. That is what Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is bestowing, Madhurya Rasa. So therefore, one can understand this spirit. Now, there are some years ago in the 80s, I was living in Vrindavan. And at that time, there were two devotees also from Holland, two boys from Holland. Yeah? And they were initiated devotees and they stayed in the temple. And then, so, you know, they they liked to go outside around Vrindavan and check out all the different babas, you know. There's like some baba, you know, and then we met this baba. Whoa, he's really good. You know, this baba, he is a gopi. Yeah, this baba is a gopi. And he can, you know, actually give you some initiation by which you can also become gopi. Yes. So they got into it. And they went to live with that baba. But because they were Westerners, they were not actually allowed to live in the ashram. And they were living in a little room next to the gate. And they had to use a water tap which was outside the wall. Because they were, after all, malechas, you know. Anyway, but they did all that for a while. Right? And one did it more serious than another. And one actually took initiation from that baba and went into it deep. And the other one, after a short while, went back home. So whatever may be, what is this business of trying to become gopis or trying to, the interest in gopi bhav, right? The consciousness of the bhav of the gopis and trying to attain the bhav of the gopis. We should understand that actually, for us, in our present condition, which is, we are here under the influence of the material energy. We cannot see Krishna. We cannot see the spiritual world. So what is the meaning of gopi bhav for us? Is that the gopis are the topmost servants of Krishna. So gopi bhav for us means actually service to Krishna. So if we are meditating on the gopis, then we should think that as the gopis give everything in service to Krishna, may I also take inspiration from the gopis to give everything in the service of Krishna. Not that we start thinking and Krishna is embracing the gopis and they're having love affairs and what if I would be a gopi too and I could be a gopi. Imagine if Krishna would embrace me. Wow, and all that, you know. That's not how we should meditate on gopi bhav. When we meditate on gopi bhav, we should simply meditate how the gopis gave everything in the service to Krishna. And we should also try and come to that platform of giving everything in the service of Krishna. Gopis just left their families for the pleasure of Krishna. They didn't care what their parents said. They didn't care what anybody thought. They didn't calculate how much money am I losing when I get involved with the Hare Krishna movement. Right? They didn't think, you know, about my flat, you know. They didn't think my car. They didn't think, you know, all these things I have. They didn't think my girlfriend, my boyfriend, my girlfriends and boyfriends, you know, and everything you may have. They didn't think all those things. They just thought of Krishna completely all the time. Srimati Radharani even said that sleeping, I can't afford it. Because sometimes when I sleep, even I forget Krishna. So I've given up sleeping. It's like, that's pretty steep, isn't it? Yeah, that's intense. These gopis, they were so extraordinary in the way they served. And that's why we put so much emphasis on the gopis. And the whole embracing and all that, you know. Let's first become pure devotees and then we can think about that. Because otherwise we might mix in some of our own mundane experiences in trying to understand these intimate dealings of Krishna and the gopis. You know, we might remember some of our own Ras Lilas here in Amsterdam, right? Some of our pastimes with girls or boys, girls pastimes that we've had in our life. So it's very difficult to understand these things. But the service, that's the most important. Even for the pure devotees. Even when you're a pure devotee, Like Prabhupada, if you actually look at what is the most important aspect of the dealings with Krishna and the gopis, it's the service. So it's not just that for us now, the most important is the service, but once you get really advanced, then the more intimate embraces and things are the most important. No, it's still the service that is always the most important. That is the essence of Gopi Bhav, the service attitude. So that we should also, you know, we should try and become real servants. Like that we meditate on the gopis. Otherwise, who are we, you know? Are we gopis? I don't know. I'm hoping to be a blade of grass, like Lord Brahma was praying and Uddhava was praying. Let the gopis trample upon me. Let me be a blade of grass. That would be more suitable. Anything else? Avadhuta.
You just mentioned that Srimati Radharani sometimes protects Krishna in the dream.
She said so, yeah.
So, I'm just curious, what is the technical explanation of that? Because the Turiya consciousness of 24-hour Krishna consciousness, it is explained to be also in the dream.
Yeah. Yeah, so, but she's pointing out that sleep is so dangerous, right? Because it is a symptom of the sleep itself, is by nature a symptom of the mode of ignorance. And one can certainly sleep for Krishna and dream about Krishna. And we see how Balaram is mentioned as an example of that, of Gudakesh, of one who had conquered sleep, and then he was sleeping. He had conquered sleep, but then he was sleeping, because while he was sleeping, he was dreaming of Krishna. So your point is correct. But somehow or other, Srimati Radharani made that statement, that I've given up sleep because sleep even conquers me. Because Prabhupada said, basically, sleep is a symptom of the mode of ignorance. So one sees that the modes of material nature, I think the lesson that we must learn from here, is that we see that the modes of material nature are so powerful that no one is exempt from the power of Maya. Right? Maya has her throwing potency. She throws. So she even throws it at Srimati Radharani. But Srimati Radharani then just responds, right? In a way that there's no way that Maya can do anything anymore. When Maya throws her potency at Srimati Radharani, that during sleep, you know, you also become covered. Radharani just responds, all right, then I won't sleep anymore. Easy. Then there's no Maya. So what kind of a devotee is she? Inconceivable. Inconceivable. Yeah, and but that is also mentioned that Srimati Radharani is saying that whenever I sleep, forgetfulness of Krishna also covers me. So we see that contradictory things are mentioned. So therefore, we see that rather than trying to, when we get these contradictions, try to take these and try to come to one conclusion, rather, because they exist both. They're both simultaneously true. That one is not, one is transcendental. But then yet, the material energy is such, the Maya energy is such, that even it attempts to cover the liberated souls. Like even Haridas Thakur was attempted, but he was not. And Haridas Thakur, Maya came personally before him. Even Radharani, Maya comes personally before Radharani. Just see. Even in her sleep, Maya comes in. But what is Maya actually coming in for? Maya actually came in to glorify Srimati Radharani. Because Srimati Radharani's glory becomes shown when by Maya's arrangement there is some obstruction. Then Srimati Radharani is showing to be more glorious. So we can understand that Krishna is somewhere behind that Maya. That is not just ordinary automatic pilot Maya. For the living being who is conditioned, everything is on automatic pilot. And the Maya that is on automatic pilot is called Mahamaya. Krishna is not interfering with it. It's just going on. Right? But in dealing with a great devotee, then we know that Krishna is behind. So ultimately, it's Yoga Maya. Ultimately, it was Krishna who wants to glorify Srimati Radharani. Ultimately.
Is it the Mahamaya or the Yoga Maya which helps the devotee?
We may sometimes. Krishna sometimes allows Mahamaya to make arrangements for our purification. You see, Krishna, it is said that when we become a devotee, that we are still under the influence of karma, but that like the fan of karma was spinning, light switched off, and the fan begins to slow down. Right? So the reactions slow down, but there are still some reactions. And said Krishna is monitoring these reactions, and he decides, sometimes he interferes, and he may take away a certain reaction, doesn't come. Or he may give a reaction at another time. And other times he doesn't interfere. And he just lets it happen. Right? So sometimes it is direct Yoga Maya when Krishna interferes. Another time it's just Mahamaya who is giving diminished reactions. And Krishna just monitors it, watches it, and lets it happen. Mm-hmm. It gets quite technical now. And then we may lose the audience. Huh? If we go too much into the technical realm, then we may lose the audience in between the syllables. Huh? Yeah. So is there any other question? No. Okay, then we stop. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.